Our third and final hour on this Bud Light Football Friday. Sandy Clef with you on Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan, your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Bud Light, the official beer sponsor of the NFL. Here we go with hour number three. We'll get back on the phones in just a few moments. Dr. Rick Perea, our guest. Want to get to a topic that's been frequently addressed, particularly on a national level, in recent weeks. But one more text that I want to get your reaction to, Bronco-related. From the 801, many times over, we've heard the Broncos say, we don't look at the scoreboard. Is this part of their focus on process, one play at a time? They've said that a few times this week. We're not looking at the scoreboard. We're not looking at 52-20, 37-21, 41-23, 49-27, or whatever the more impressive lead might be during the course of any of those games. We're not scoreboard watching.
Yes, that's absolutely the process orientation. You know, when you look at companies in terms of their bottom line, their profit, they look at quarterly reports, they look at their P&Ls, their profit and loss statements, and all those things. But they don't look at it necessarily on a daily basis. You know, the Broncos really, when they go out and play, it's process, it's play by play, series by series, quarter by quarter, half by half. And so they break it down into those segments. And so to keep looking at the scoreboard, let's say you're ahead by two or three touchdowns, there's a natural inherent human psychology to want to relax a little bit. So what the coaches are trying to do is really to say, hey, it doesn't necessarily matter what the quantitative analysis is. It's the qualitative analysis, the play-by-play, and we just need to execute our game plan. And if we do that, the process orientation, obviously the outcome orientation will take care of itself.
All right. More so than the games themselves in college football this year, the primary source of conversation and discussion has come out of the debate over paying college athletes.
Yes.
And it's been particularly prevalent with the O'Bannon suit out there and the idea and EA Sports removing itself from that lawsuit and settling, that there seems to be a movement, even the NCAA acknowledging that, yeah, maybe we need to reform our system, if not totally transform it and radically change it. What are your thoughts about this? Again, we hear the quantitative perspective that it's that's at the heart of the debate. From a qualitative point of view, what's the perspective?
Well, first let me preface it by saying this. I was a college football player, a scholarship college football player, so I know the situation where, you know, you need money on a monthly basis. But again, depending on the conference you play in, it depends on how the money is distributed. A lot of conferences, you get book tuition fees, and then you get a check every month. So it's up to you to kind of frame what your living expenses are. If you live with five or six guys, you can reduce your rent quite a bit. If you live by yourself, your rent's going to be quite a bit more. But here's my perspective, Sandy. You know, you talked about the quantitative piece, and I hear a lot of arguments saying, you know, these athletes bring in millions of dollars to their institutions,
right,
and therefore they should be paid. I disagree with that. Let me tell you why. Because it's hard to apply a capitalist model towards an institution of higher learning, which theoretically is a nonprofit organization. Some of your private schools, you could argue, are for-profit. But in a public institution, it's a place for higher learning. And athletes' primary goal there is to get an education. I look back at the qualitative aspects of what happens when you're a college – I'll just speak for myself, a college football player – how do you put a dollar figure on the value you get of the experiences you have, the relationships you develop with coaches, the relationships you develop with players?
Sure.
You know, Sandy, after 30 years, my defensive coordinator from college is still a great mentor to me. I can call him at any time, any place, anywhere, and he gives me such valuable insight. How do you put a price tag on that? The relationships I've built, the guys I played college football with, we still get together, we have alumni groups. How do you put a price tag on that? My beliefs and values that I really deploy to my own family on a daily basis, that comes from my college experience. My father brought a lot of that, but it was also my coaches. So I think the qualitative piece is we're so privileged to be college athletes. I think to ask for getting paid overtly, if you will, money, mm-hmm. is asking too much, because we are getting paid. Our tuition's being paid. Our full, you know, expenses at college are being paid. You know, I mentioned this to my wife this morning and talking to her, and she said, you know, at Alabama, she played volleyball at Alabama. She says, you know, I made more money staying in summer school and staying there than if I would have come home and worked a job. Because you get the stipend of your scholarship. So
right.
I think that the platform, for example, college football players, it provides you a platform to take that next step to the NFL. Without that college stage or platform, you wouldn't even have that opportunity to go into the NFL. So I think from a qualitative perspective, again, quantitative is one argument, qualitative is another one. From a qualitative perspective, there are so many rich experiences you take away from that being a college intercollegiate athlete that really we're not even talking about and valuing here. In our society, it's so quantitatively oriented.
Yes.
Everything's got to come back to money. Well, no, it doesn't. What about my abilities as a father? I'm a better father because of my experience as a college athlete. I'm a better husband. I'm a better business person. I'm a better college professor. You know, the fact that I went off and got my PhD after being a college football player, I'm very proud of that. And part of that is being coached by great coaches, being mentored by great mentors, and being around great people. So I think we should slow down and not only assess the quantitative piece, but the qualitative piece as well.
We should be having the debate, but it should be qualitative as well as quantitative.
Yeah.
That's your point.
The whole college experience and what we take away from that.
All right. A few more minutes here. And questions pouring in. I want to get to as many of them as we can. Again, from the 520, is it possible for a team to keep its unit cohesion for an entire season? In the military, once our squad came together, we were unstoppable. We were brothers.
Oh, yeah.
It's tough to assess what is going on with the Broncos since we're not in the locker room. We're not in the trenches with them during games, obviously. But is it a sense, operating again from that perspective that you bring, that there is some correlation between what can happen over the course of a season and what can be preserved over the course of a season between a football team and a military squad?
Absolutely. And the texter said it well. We became brothers. I mean, you literally become a family system. Cohesion, yes. To answer his question, his or her question, I would say that, yeah, cohesion can last a long period of time. Peak performance can't, though. Those are two different things. Peak performance, like what we're seeing with the Broncos, can last a certain amount of time. There's what we call the inverted U hypothesis, which means that there's going to be ebbs and flows.
Right.
Now, the Broncos' low level, okay, the ebb or the flow, may be they only win by 7 points, or they only win by 9 points, or whatever it may be. But the texture is very
correct. And just as a sideline, I don't want to interrupt you, but it just occurs to me as you're saying that this week some have suggested that the Broncos might not win this game by 16 or more points, and it's almost viewed by some fans as an insult.
Right.
You might as well pick them to lose by 20 as to pick them to win by only 7 to 10 points.
Right. Isn't that interesting how we frame that way?
It is interesting how the psychology works that way.
The psychology behind that, if we're only winning by 7 or 9, it's not a great win. The bottom line is a W is a W. And the Broncos, I think, will continue on this level, but I don't think they'll be winning by 21 points every week. But the texter is exactly right. That task cohesion really builds that overall social cohesion within the organization. And it's the same cohesion we have in corporate world, in the military. They're all very similar. And when he brings up brotherhood, that's what he's talking about. There's a high level of social cohesion in organizations when they take care of the task cohesion.
Does, on a football team, that cohesion apply to offense, defense, special teams all interacting? Because it seems with this Bronco team, there isn't all that much separation. In fact, cooperation and a complementary feeling. We know, for example, last week, the offense didn't score all the points. There was a block punt, special teams touchdown.
Yep.
There was a return for a touchdown. The Broncos have scored almost 10, well, a little more than 10% of their points this year on special teams, 18 out of 179.
Right. That's a great question, Sandy, because you look at offense, defense, and special teams. Theoretically, three separate parts of a team, but they're all interdependent. And so what I mean with task cohesion, if the defense does their job, then social cohesion takes over between the defense and the offense because the defense appreciates the offense taking care of their job. The offense appreciates the defense taking care of their job. So, again, if they take care of their task, special teams, for example, then there is a a social cohesion that comes between those three elements that makes them really interdependent. And that's when you have peak performance. And that's what the Broncos are exhibiting right now. There's ultimate high levels of peak performance because there is that task cohesion, which leads to the social cohesion, which leads to peak performance. And it's really unprecedented. And again, I come back to the inverted U hypothesis. At some point, they're not going to win by 21 every game. But
you can still preserve the other thing that you're talking about, even if a month from now they're not winning by 22 points a game anymore.
Absolutely. They still have task cohesion. They still have social cohesion. It may not be at peak levels, but it may be at optimum levels. Those two different things. The difference between optimum and peak is just a little bit, and sometimes that's all the difference it needs in the NFL to win or lose a game.
And again, to look at the other side, those who aren't Bronco fans or reacting are saying, well, you're saying when you continue to talk about 4-0 and how they're distancing themselves from the field, you're saying they can maintain peak performance in a quantitative sense all year. That's not what we're saying.
No,
that's not
what
we're saying.
We're saying
they can keep winning, but nobody is saying they can continue to play at this level in the sense that they'll continue to win by more than three touchdowns per game.
I'll put it this way, Sandy. Peyton Manning will throw some picks this year.
Okay? Really?
He will throw some picks.
That's the revelation we're looking for. You say he will throw at least one.
He will.
At some point.
He'll throw at least five picks this year, Sandy. He will.
Okay. I like that even better. You're putting the framework. You're saying five interceptions between now and then.
That's just probably he absolutely will. I don't wish him on him. I don't know where they're going to be distributed.
Oh, you'll get some texts expressing hate on that one, I'm sure. Great stuff as always. It's a great pleasure to have you on once again.
Thank you, Sandy. And by the way, you didn't mention I was wearing blue today. Now, the question is this Bronco blue? Is this Bronco blue or Cowboy blue? I'll leave that for you to discern.
I think it looks more like Bronco blue to me.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Sandy.
Dark blue. Yes, absolutely. Dr. Rick Perea, professor of sports psychology, Metro State University of Colorado. Your phone calls, your texts for our remaining 45 minutes on this Bud Light Football Friday here on Denver Sports Station. Sports Radio 104.3. Joined earlier on this Bud Light Football Friday on Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan, your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Adam Meyer, RealMoneySports.com, the great Terrell Davis, Chad Brown, about 90 minutes ago. And within the last 45 minutes, Dr. Rick Perea, professor of sports psychology, Metro State, and the University of Colorado. So lots to digest there. We'll continue on the phones, but we want to remind you of the Avalanche and Nashville Predators tonight at Pepsi Center starting at 7 o'clock, and we have a family four-pack of tickets to see the Avs take on the Preds later today, tonight at 7. Family night packages include four tickets, four Pepsis, and four family meals for only $99. Call Ticket Horse at 303-53-HORSE or visit ColoradoAvalanche.com to get your tickets today. But we have a family four-pack of tickets to give away this hour. Here's how we'll do it. Patrick Waugh has been involved in controversial circumstances before as a player. Never one more notorious than this particular incident described by Mike Haynes.
Here we go! Oh, yeah, baby! It's Waugh on Osgood. Waugh gets in. Holds on to Osgood. A left by Osgood. A right by Waugh. He connects on another right. Another right by Waugh. Another right by Waugh. The sweater. Osgood's coming off. Waugh drives him back to midnight. A right by Waugh. He connects. Another right by Waugh. Another right. An uppercut by Waugh. A right by Waugh. A right by Waugh. An uppercut. He's holding on. He's doing great against Osgood. It's center ice. Yeah, you better believe it, baby. Patrick Waugh and Osgood at center. Osgood's coming back. Another right by Waugh. He's pushing towards the red wing.
Now, things obviously did not escalate to quite that point the other night when Patrick got into a shouting match with Anaheim coach Bruce Boudreau. But the next time you hear that Mike Haynes call of the famous Waugh-Osgood fight, of what, about 16 years ago now. Boy, does time fly by. Be the first to call the next time you hear that fight call from Mike Haynes. You're the first to call. You'll have a family four-pack of tickets to see the Avs and Nashville Predators later tonight at Pepsi Center starting at 7 o'clock. 303-228-1043, 295-88, Total Beverage Text Line. We go next on the phones to Steve. You're on the Fan with Sandy Clef. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, Sandy. A brilliant interview with Dr. Berea. That was amazing.
Glad you enjoyed it.
If you allow me to vent for a few seconds,
certainly.
I have a question at the end of this for you.
Vent away.
thanks. To quote the brilliant Yogi Berra, it's deja vu all over again. Almost exactly a year ago today, a West Coast team's player took a run at an up-and-coming Avalanche teenager.
That was Landeskog, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And there was no penalty and no fine. And the foul stench of Brendan Shanahan has already reared its ugly head to begin this year because the Avs, which I, you know, they kept the Joe Sacco glass up and didn't reinforce it for Patrick Waugh, and he gets fined $10,000. But once again, there's nothing done at all to the guy who intends to injure a player. And my question to you, and, you know, Shanahan was a punk with the Blues. He was a punk with the Red Wings. He's a punk as Bettman's henchman. And I guess my question to you is, Sandy, how many incidents of what appears to me to be bias do we have to go through, or we just have to say, thank you, sir, can I have another? And I'd like to hang up and listen to your
answer. All right, let's be careful to draw the distinction. The player discipline is handled by Brendan Shanahan. Colin Campbell handled the business of Waz being fined $10,000 yesterday by the league. So that they're different areas. But my reaction in general is the same as yours. I don't know that putting a particular spin on this having to do with Red Wings, Avalanche, and Shanahan's role in that rivalry back particularly in the 1990s, very early 2000s. I don't think we get very far with that, but I do think it's interesting that those, including other coaches around the National Hockey League, such as Ken Hitchcock of the St. Louis Blues, who are saying, this is really scary what happened the other night. I'd go after those people at least as much as Shanahan for whatever discipline may or may not be enacted against a player or an Avalanche skater in this instance, who I think Patrick Waugh was certainly trying to protect, at least indirectly, through his actions the other night. But for Hitchcock and any of the other, presumably otherwise intelligent coaches around the league, to look at the incident the other night and say, that's bad for the game or that's scary, please. It's a piece of plexiglass. And what basically happened was two coaches, not one yelling at the other and the other just looking up and saying, I don't know what's going on. Two coaches yelling at each other. Boudreau yelling at Waugh first. Actually, if you're talking about what initiated that exchange, it was Boudreau going at Waugh before Waugh was involved at all with Boudreau. But in any case, to label that as scary, no, the shot that this same defenseman took at a Calgary Flame last year, knee on knee, same kind of cheap shot that in that case took the Flame skater out of the lineup for a considerable portion of time. That's scary. That's bad for the game. It's bad for the game when there's a fight the other night in the Toronto-Montreal game and George Parros gets his face smashed into the ice and suffers a concussion. Long-term effects to be determined. That's scary. That's bad for the game. For an otherwise intelligent person like Ken Hitchcock to characterize what happened the other night between Juan Boudreau and blame Waugh exclusively for it and say, that's scary, that's bad for the game. That's as dumb a thing as I've heard an otherwise intelligent person say in a long time. And apparently Barry Trotz, the Nashville coach, said some of the same things in reaction to the incident. It's interesting, those coaches with a background more similar to Patrick Waugh, Daryl Sutter of the L.A. Kings, for example, kind of sided with Waugh or laughed it off as harmless and actually great for the league because it got the league attention yesterday. It was harmless. What happened the other night was fun. It was harmless, not to be taken terribly seriously. And for somebody like Hitchcock to say, that's scary, that's bad for the game, that's the kind of sentiment you should be attacking. Whether the league chooses to fine or discipline a player or not, that's what we should be talking about. The NHL and some of the people who represent the voice of the NHL, they're the people, I think, who have to be brought into line, brought into more of a reasonable perspective. 1127, Sandy Clef with you. This is a Bud Light Football Friday on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. By Jason Garrett, the Dallas Cowboys coach this week. As Clef Talk continues, Sandy Clef with you on a Bud Light Football Friday here on Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan, your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Garrett said, people are saying, boy, Peyton Manning's on a roll. It started in about 1998. A terrific piece. I want to recommend it again in USA Today, if you haven't seen it already, on page 8C, entitled Peyton Manning Defying Logic. Injury might be Broncos' only worry about QB. And it's Eric Brady, Jim Corbett, our friend Lindsey Jones, writing about Manning, writing about the Broncos. And they go back in the piece, and they do go back to 1998, as Jason Garrett suggests we all do. And they look at the number of sacks he's taken. And even in his rookie year, which I think was a 3-13 season for the Indianapolis Colts, he was only sacked 22 times. Less than 4% of his drop-back pass attempts resulted in a sack. The one year where it got a little bit high, 5% of the time, was 2001. He was sacked 29 times. In every other year, he's been well-protected, or he's done a good job of getting rid of the ball so the pass rush can't get to him. And here so far this season in Denver, he's been sacked 5 times in 4 games, a little more than 3% of the time. Last year it was 3.5% of the time. But, yes, it's a reminder that even as you might say he's playing his best football right now, his best football, it's a matter of degree. Very slight difference. Very, very slight. And even going back to his rookie year, 1998, he was pretty good. By the end of that year, nobody thought he was a bust. The other quarterback in that draft, Ryan Leaf, by the end of that first year, everybody knew that he was a bust. 303-228-1043, 295-88, Total Beverage Sex Line. We'll get back to the phones in just a few moments. Great point by the texter from the 720. There are a lot of aging hockey coaches floating around the NHL who are going to feel threatened by Patrick Waugh and other younger coaches. I couldn't agree more with that. And I think it's hilarious that people like Hitchcock and Boudreau are kind of inclined to speak contemptuously of Waugh's major junior coaching past. This is the kind of thing that may have worked in major junior, but this is the NHL. These are two guys who played most of their professional hockey on the minor league level and coached for years on the minor league level before getting their NHL head coaching opportunities. Of all the people who should not be dismissive of Patrick Waugh's coaching past, it should be these two guys. Talking about, well, that's something you do in major junior. Yeah, and taking cheap shots, that's something you do if you're a Bush leaguer. Talking about the Bushes, whether it's minor league or major junior. You know, when you're in the bushes, when you're defending or excusing or perhaps ordering your players to go out there and take cheap shot runs at people. And if you go back and look at the video of the play in question from the other night, Lovejoy hitting Nathan MacKinnon as a cheap shot. He took a run at him. As Patrick pointed out yesterday, he's got a history of doing it. He did it with Glenn Cross of Calgary last year, and he missed a major portion of the season a year ago. Did the same. So the guy's got a history. And by the way, as we suggested yesterday, Ken Hitchcock and Bruce Boudreau are not particularly popular themselves within the coaching fraternity. They have their critics. And with respect to players who clearly respect Patrick Waugh, certainly the players in the Avalanche locker room too, these are two guys who've gone to war with their players through the years. Now, they're both terrific coaches. And especially in a technical sense, and you look at their records, Bruce Boudreau and Ken Hitchcock are terrific coaches. But for them to be lecturing on these subjects is pretty rich. And from the 720, hey, let the other teams and coaches get scared to play the Avalanche. That would be a first over the last decade. As an Avalanche fan, I love it. That's from Dan. 303-228-1043 and 295-88 on the Total Beverage text line. Here's a football hockey connection, and it's right at the end of this USA Today piece that we were talking about. When you look at Manning, who do you think of among other quarterbacks in the NFL down through the years, among performers in other sports? Do you think of Manning reminding you of Jordan? Do you think of Manning reminding you of John Unitas or Joe Montana? Do you think of Manning reminding you of Wayne Gretzky, let's say? I think the Gretzky comparison is most apt. And from the USA Today piece today comes the following, the concluding three paragraphs of the piece. Wayne Gretzky had hockey seasons when he scored at an otherworldly level, as Manning soars now. They used to say of Gretzky what they say of Manning. The way to beat him is to hit him. Right? Now, any of you hockey fans out there certainly remember, and back in the late 70s, early 1980s, saw a lot of Wayne Gretzky when he first came into the National Hockey League out of the World Hockey Association and the Edmonton Oilers once they were absorbed into the National Hockey League, and they occupied the same division as the old Colorado Rockies. So we saw Gretzky, I think it was 8 times a year back then, late 70s, starting 79, 80, and continuing on into the early 1980s, of course, until the Rockies left town following the 1981-82 season. And I remember hearing that all the time, the way for anybody to get to Gretzky was to hit him, the same way we hear that about Manning all the time. Blitz him, hit him early, and everything else. And here's the conclusion, though, of the piece today as far as that comparison is concerned. But you can't hit what you can't catch. Or as then-Minnesota North Stars general manager Lou Nanny famously said, you can't hit Gretzky with a handful of confetti. And I thought, what a great line. And you could apply it to Manning right now. And I know he has been hit some, but I'm not sure he's been hit once all year while actually attempting to pass. He's been sacked 5 times. But in terms of being hit as he's releasing, I thought there was one play last week where he got a pass off behind the line of scrimmage, perhaps, as he was being maybe dragged down from behind. So that may, I think you might be able to find an example of his being hit maybe at least once or twice as he's been throwing. But that line applies to Manning, doesn't it? You can't hit Manning with a handful of confetti. And if you can't hit him, you can't disrupt him. And if you can't disrupt him right now, you can't play against him. But that's why I think, when I think of Manning, when I'm watching Manning, I think of Wayne Gretzky, especially during the times that we saw a lot of him live here in Denver when he was playing for Edmonton. Not toward the end of his career when he was bouncing around a little bit, St. Louis and the Rangers. I think he played for the Rangers when the Avalanche got back into town. We didn't see him at all, really, live. The Avalanche were here. We may have seen him a handful of times, but not on any kind of regular basis did we see Gretzky the way we had late 70s, early 80s around here when the Hockey Rockies were going up against the Edmonton Oilers. Not all that successfully, but we saw Gretzky. And that's when I look at Manning right now and the heights he's reached in terms of his performance and how you just can't get to him. You can't disrupt him. You can't hit him. I think of Wayne Gretzky when I look at Manning right now, and that's a great Lou Nanning line. You can't hit Gretzky with a handful of confetti, and that applies to Peyton Manning right now, too. 303-228-1043, 29588 on the Total Beverage text line. This is Clough Talk on a Bud Light Football Friday on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3, The Fan. Stay with us.
Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3, The Fan.
There we go! Oh, yeah, baby! It's Juan Osgood! Juan gets in, holds on to Osgood, a left by Osgood, a right by Juan! He connects on another right by Juan! Another right by Juan! The sweater, Osgood's coming off! Juan drives him back to midnight, a right by Juan, connected! Another right by Juan! Another right! Uppercut by Juan! A right by Juan! A right by Juan! An uppercut! He's holding on, he's doing great against Osgood, it's center ice! Yeah! You better believe it, baby! That's it, Juan Osgood at center. Osgood's coming back. Another right by Waugh. He pushed him toward the Red Wing back.
What do we like better? Do we like, because we played them both this week, do we like the Haynes call, what about them apples, Gilmore? That was the Joe Sakic fight. Patrick had more than one. That was the most notorious, infamous, famous of the Patrick Waugh fights. He had a confrontation with Mike Vernon at one time, but the fight with Osgood was the signature Patrick Waugh fight moment. Not the only time that Patrick got involved, but we do have a winner. And that winner will be going to the game tonight with a four-pack of tickets to watch the Avs take on the Nashville Predators, 7 o'clock start at Pepsi Center. So congratulations to our winner. We have some lines open, 303-228-1043, 29588 on the Total Beverage text line. Which did you like better? Not it's the better fight, the call. The Haynes call of how about them apples, Gilmore, the Sakic fight with Doug Gilmore back in the day, or Waugh versus Osgood. And that was on the road. Now, if you forget, the Sakic fight took place here in Denver. So there was more of a partisan reaction in favor of Joe Sakic, who, as far as we can remember, didn't fight on any other occasion. But if you forget the Haynes call, let's hear the Haynes call now of the Sakic fight.
The Avalanche have made it a 2-1 game.
And he just scored a goal.
On a goal by Super Joe. Now Gilmore and Joe Sakic start shoving each other. Sakic has not had a face. Sakic with a fighter right by Sakic. He knocks down the helmet. Up and come another right by Sakic. Another right by Sakic.
He
just beat up Doug Gilmore. Super Joe just scored a goal, and then he beat up Doug Gilmore. How do you like them apples, Gilmore?
You gotta love it. 303-228-1043, 29588 on the Total Beverage text line. And this kind of comes out of the blue from the 720. Sandy, I'm playing Madden, and Vaughn Miller is so dominant, I can't wait till we get him back. Let me say that. I think you'll see signs on Sunday of the Broncos missing Vaughn Miller maybe a little more in this game than they've missed him in the previous four. Because, you know, I think Romo, with all due respect to Flacco, Eli, Michael Vick last week, Romo's playing on a higher level right now. He's playing more efficiently, certainly in more a mistake-free fashion than Flacco, who threw five picks in Buffalo, right? And Eli's thrown a lot of interceptions so far this year. Terrell Pryor doesn't throw that often or that well. Vic's erratic. So I think they're, of the five quarterbacks they will have faced by the time 6 o'clock rolls around on Sunday night, I think Romo will be the most dangerous, and maybe in a lot of ways the hardest to pressure, with the exception of Pryor and maybe Vic. But Romo, in terms of all the factors we talk about, mobility, getting rid of the ball on time, rapport with his receivers, everything else, I think they're probably going to miss Miller more in this game, maybe even Champ in this game, than they've missed either one over the course of the first four. From the 303, I love all the comparisons, but if Manning were to win the Super Bowl this year, to whom could you compare him? Really, no one. Because no one else has won a Super Bowl with two different teams. He'd have to be considered the greatest. What do you think? I agree with you. Not everyone agrees with that idea, but I think if he won a second here in Denver with a different team at age 37, we know Elway won a couple after his 37th birthday. But Elway's stated goal for Manning, his objective when he signed him, I want to make him the best quarterback of all time. And I think implied in that projection was the idea that, yeah, he'd have to win a Super Bowl or two here in Denver. And Elway would build a team around him strong enough to make that goal realistic. Realistically achievable. So, yeah, I like that observation. I like this one, too, from the 303. Comparing Manning with Gretzky, does this mean now that Elway will have to sign McSorley and Stu Grimson? That'd be a pretty good entertainment right there. That's from Matty B. What do you need with McSorley and Grimson when you have Clark and Franklin? We'll get Orlando's thoughts next week on what took place the other night. Orlando knows his hockey. Well, 303, I bet the ratings for the Avalanche will be higher tonight than they were on opening night. Possibly. Possibly. Gotta love the Haynes call from the 303 on Sakic and Gilmore. Yeah, I like that a little better. Because that's unexpected. You know, the Osgood thing was more part of a general brawl. The Sakic thing was strictly coming out of a goal scored by Sakic, especially. It's rare enough to see Sakic fight under any circumstances. But to have him fight after he scored a goal, and you know, I think the level of it being unexpected much higher. 720, Gilmore and Sakic exploring commercial opportunities. Now, Gilmore and Sakic should do commercials for King Supers. Gilmore is in the produce aisle looking at green and red apples. Then Sakic comes from behind and slowly says, "How do you like them apples?" Gilmore looking to the camera in disgust. Boy, we have marketing geniuses out there now. I like that idea. Very good idea. I agree with this, too, from the 303. The Sakic apples call was Haynes at his best on radio. I love the old AM cracking and how Haynes just erupted. It was great. You can feel the moment when he went from the radio guy to a fan. It was just awesome. As well as the times he ran out of breath. That's the best for me. Especially during the longer call. But there was a little bit. Yes, it was breathtaking. Absolutely breathtaking. All right, we're done for our 3 hours here, but we're only beginning on a Football Friday. Now moving into the afternoon phase with Drew and Scott standing by to join you in a matter of moments. Yes, a Bud Light Football Friday on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. Stay with us.